Good evening, everybody. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I'm Ann Temkin, the Blanchette Hooker Rockefeller Curator of Painting and Sculpture and organizer of the exhibition Color Chart. I'm delighted you're here for the final conversation on color that's being held in conjunction with the exhibition. We're very honored tonight to have two multi-talented, to say the least, speakers or conversationalists with us. The format for the evening will be a 15 or so minute presentation by each of them, and then, as you might predict, a dialogue among the three of us afterwards, and then opening it out to questions so that it will be a conversation, hopefully, among everyone in the room. The topic for tonight is chromophilia. It takes off from the 2000 book by David Batchelor, our second speaker, Chromophobia, and refers not only to his own chromophilia, but that clearly demonstrated to us during the course of this exhibition by a colleague of ours in our conservation department right here at MoMA. Chris McGlinchey is the Sally and Michael Gordon conservation scientist. It's kind of scary sounding. In our conservation department. He came to MoMA in 1999. He's been here almost a decade. And he has been working at MoMA after about 15 years as chemist at the Metropolitan Museum of Art up the street. The fact of Chris being a chemist is something we, his colleagues, all knew all along. The thing that I guess most of the rest of us didn't know was that he is a closeted collector of color charts from the last 120 years that if we would have even begun to have brought them in life here, we would have had warfare break out by everybody trying to grab at them. So we're going to have to be content with a slide presentation of some tidbits from his collection. But we spent many, many wonderful visits to the conservation department, and Chris just wonderfully shared these things that he found, as he will explain to you, in all sorts of unexpected sources, but proving, basically, the hypothesis behind the show, or not proving it, but affirming it, that the creation of the commercial color chart at the end of the 19th century, which went along with, essentially, the development of mass-produced paints, so that you needed something to advertise what all these different paints were, was sort of an amazingly weird preview into the abstract art of the century that would be coming up. David Batchelor, also multi-sided, known to many as a writer, not only from his book that I mentioned, Chromophobia, but several others, including Minimalism, published by Tate Publications in 1997, and most recently, Color, which you can find in our bookstore along with Chromophobia, just published this year, and an amazing anthology on writings on color for the last 150 years. And it's the Bartlett's quotations for color that will be forever used, or for a good long time used, by anyone needing to talk about an artist or non-artist's remarks on color in modern times. And we're very grateful to have him here, both in that regard and as an artist in the exhibition. His Found Monochromes of London are on view in the entrance gallery, first gallery in the exhibition, just right when you get to the top of the escalator or the elevators off the sixth floor. There you are. And his Found Monochromes of London, looking out at the city of New York, and I hope alerting all of us when we leave the exhibition to look for some found monochromes in New York, which he will not want to hear about because he's busy enough with his London ones. But I thank all of you for coming, and most especially I thank Chris and David. And Chris, I'll welcome you up here if everybody's ready.
Thank you, Anne. I'm just going to jump in. Have a lot of slides to show. The first few that I have are not from my collection. These are paint tradesmen's cards from the late 17th or late 18th, early 19th century in England. One is from Ian Bristow's book, Interior House Painting, Colors and Technology, 1615 to 1840. And another is from Rosamund Harley's book, Artist's Pigments, 1600 to 1835. Paint technology was so radically different after the mid-19th century that their selection of establishing a terminus date of the mid-19th century makes sense. But what's really interesting is, and I'm going to read the fine print, which you probably cannot read. On the card on the left, it says, sell all sorts of colors ready prepared that gentlemen, with the assistance of a printed direction, may set their labors to paint any kind of work and gain a saving of 30%. So clearly, they're trying to encourage people that are not professionally trained painters to take the brush and do it themselves. The second trade card on the right says, sells all sorts of color, dry or prepared in oil, and all sorts of watercolors, brushes, tools, and pencils of all sorts. Fine calcined smalts, all sorts of lacquer, roll, brimstone, and sulfur, yellow and black rosin. What's interesting about this, and scholars have pointed out in this period, that there's a transition from alchemy to science. And referring to brimstone is kind of the end of the alchemy era. And there's clearly science is taking over and developing a more rigorous way of exploiting these materials. Oh, I'm pointing the wrong direction. Here we have, fast forward 100 years, circa 1880, a color chart from the United States. And it's quite evident, prepared for immediate use. The way these color charts in the late 19th century were made is you can see the brush strokes. These were painted out in mass and cut up into, there was probably a stamp the shape of this shield, and then just glued into place. And they're really, if you think of the previous cards, even though they're trying to encourage non-skilled painters to become skilled painters, you really have to know what you're looking for. You have to know what you're after. You have to have knowledge. But here, the colors just pop out at you and almost inspire you to grab a brush. It gets better. This is from a catalog from 1880, again by the same company, Longman and Martinez. The date is actually January 1880, so it's quite specific. I'm going to read the text that follows below on the favorite cam. The favorite cam. As shown in the above cut, and I assume that in reference to cut, they're talking about the printing technique used to make this drawing, will meet with the approval of every consumer of paint who has heretofore been compelled to cut off the top of the can. The favorite can is easily opened, and the top makes a cover which enables the consumer to preserve the paint. What a novel idea. It's really, if you think of the technology at the mid-19th century, the artist's collapsible paint tube is invented in around 1840. Very small quantities of paint. This is allowing you to store much larger quantities of paint. And I keep doing that. Here's another one from about the same era. Chilton paints mixed ready for use. And again, they're really, you know, bear in mind that there's no attempt at reproducing a color spectrum here. They're basically just making the paints they have the capacity to make. There's no logic to the Roy G. Biv rainbow spectrum. And they're really, if you read the fine print that they squeeze in at every margin, they're really trying to be accommodating. Put up in 1-pound cans for family use, And 1/8, 1/4, 1/2, and 1 gallon cans, also in 5, 10, 15, and 20 gallon kegs. And it just goes on.
And in barrels.
So this is an early paint industry that is really trying to define itself. Who's the community of users here? They're basically defining it as they go along. And I'm pleased to read that these are the best pigments known to science for durability and preservative qualities. Whenever I found information about prices, you go to one of these little inflation calculators. Interestingly, the price for these paints is somewhere between $20 and $30 a gallon. Basically, adjusted for inflation, that's the same price as you pay for about a gallon of paint today. Good science was going into the formulation of these paints. This is one of my personal favorites. Again, it's from about the same date, and this is a little takeaway card. It's not a bona fide color chart because it's not really inspiring you of what the company's paint options are. But if you look at it, what it is doing in a amusing way is educating the unskilled potential painter on how to estimate how much paint they need for a barn. And so here it gives you the dimensions of the barns, and it says you're going to need about 16 gallons of paint to cover this, to paint this structure with two coats of paint. If this company, if Pierce's company was trying to attract professional painters, they would not give such basic information. This is something that is probably taught to the first, on the first day of the job. So really, they're trying, again, they're making an effort to educate the non-skilled gentleman and on how to paint paint. I don't know if you've seen this, but here's the can, and there are the stripes. So this is a really fascinating brochure. It's not in the best of condition, but this is actually, by my estimation, a radical departure in paint-making technology. In the late 19th century, there was this fascination with rubber, and they didn't know what made rubber rubber. And one of the experiments that they did in the late 19th century is they distilled it, basically converting it into a liquid. And I am fairly confident that instead of turpentine, what they added to linseed oil was liquid rubber. I analyzed the paints inside this catalog, and they have this combination of hardened rubber and linseed oil. So really there's this effort of trying to make a more durable paint than linseed oil. And inside this brochure, there are some wonderful testimonials. The Ingersoll paint is unquestionably the best paint manufactured in this country. This is the testimony of thousands of patrons I have met all over the country. Signed, the Honorable Mortimer Whitehead, lecturer of the National Grains, Patrons of Husbandry. And if you Google this guy, he was actually an academic, and he clearly was a notable citizen of his time. Another testimonial, I am induced to write this article knowing that the evidence is so abundant and conclusive that the Ingersoll paint is a very superior article that it would be an injustice to remain silent. Fraternally, Andrew L. Davis, February 8th, 1889. I don't know whether to believe those things or not, but the fact that Whitehead was an academic and, clearly his reputation was at stake here. So he did have some interest, and he really felt strongly about these paints. What's interesting or what's problematic about these paints is they were probably more durable painted on a wall and inside the book. They just never dried correctly. And so when opening it, they... the paint stuck and everything. So all sorts of problems with this paint, and that's why you don't see liquid rubber paint anymore. But it is an effort to try to advance the technology.
So here are two paint counter books that I have. And in the early 20th century, this is how you would buy paint. You'd go to a hardware store and flip through this book, and you would pick out a type of paint and a color. And within these books, you have individual brochures glued into heavier pages. And, for example, they include brochures on interior, exterior paint, wall, trim, and floor paint, radiator paint, farm tool implement paint, barn paint, carriage paint, bicycle paint, and bathroom paint and furniture paint. So you have this broad spectrum of paints that you have by just flipping through this book. And, I mean, I think the Green Book has over 350 unique paint samples in it. So if you could imagine, and I estimate that this book was first printed in 1907, but its use was continued on up until the mid-20s. So it really became this fascinating time where you had options. You had amazing options. And Anne has pointed out the similarity to the Richter series, which is, if you look at the profile of these chips, it's quite close to the ones that Richter have. So now here's the quiz. When you flip through those books, you see figures depicted, and some of them are professional painters. Some of them are novice men. This guy's painting with two brushes. And I suspect that's a small... It's a little misleading, but I suspect that's a smaller brush just for details. But I could be wrong. And you see a woman painting. So the question I pose to you is, who was the market audience here? Who were the manufacturers of these catalogs pitching their paint to? I mean, I'm not actually going to quiz you, but think of that in your mind, because the next slide goes to the statistics. And so I counted all the brochures. The Sherwin-Williams catalog has 7 people out of 28 showing people painting. And isn't this interesting? You have a majority of people illustrated as women painting. That's their market. And it's really telling that they're really identifying women as a market segment that they can target. I find that fascinating. 1920 is when women had the right to vote, but Sherwin-Williams recognizes that they could wield a brush. But bear in mind that both the professional painter, these books were really not targeted so much for the professional painter. So here's another brochure from a little bit later, probably the mid-1930s. And this beautifully illustrates what commercial, let's call it house paint for lack of a better term, the intrinsic qualities that commercial house paint has. The goal was to develop a paint that dried quickly, and it says dries dust-free in an hour, hard in 4 hours. This is the key thing. The red paint is really opaque. So they're suggesting here that in one coat application, you completely can cover out the original paint underneath. And the second thing, which is implied in the literature, but it's also kind of illustrated here, is that the brush strokes flow away. So the quality of your paint job is not to impart your brush strokes. It's not to build up transparent layers. It's to efficiently conceal the substrate underneath. This is something quite unique from artist's paint. Artist's paint has issues of transparency integrated into it. You choose your paint based on whether or not you want an opaque paint or a transparent paint. For house paint, the goal is to formulate a paint that has good hiding properties. Poor hiding properties means many different paint layers are going to be required to block it out. Wasn't always the case, but that was the goal. Friends have pointed out that this Windsor chair could easily have its original paint, and had the chair remained in its original paint, it would be worth a lot more. but again, you know, in this country, you have the Depression going on. Many of the advertisements were pitched at people that were kind of tired of their surroundings and wanted to rejuvenate their home and just didn't have the financial resources to just throw everything out and buy new furniture. Many of the advertisements, which I don't really collect because they actually don't have paint samples attached to them, clearly illustrate this. The Duco, for example, has this wonderful ad of an attic space where half of the image is just black and white gray furniture, and just you see a brush sweeping across the surface, and everything is colored, and voila, what's old is new again. Ripolin, I don't know how much of you are familiar with this particular paint, but it was something that was quickly appropriated by artists like Duchamp and Picabia, and certainly Picasso. Interestingly, with regard to these paints, it started out as just a regular linseed oil paint, and as the technology progressed, it became an alkyd. As you read the label on these various cans of paint, they don't tell you that. And this was the expertise of the paint manufacturing company, is they had the capacity to obscure these intrinsic properties, or rather the chemistry, and basically make an alkyd behave like a linseed oil, or traditional oil-based paint. So these are considerations. What's really like the Lustiquick, the Ripolin was formulated to have the same type of properties, dry fast, be opaque, and dry to a smooth surface. So in other words, brushwork is designed intentionally to just smooth out and disappear. As an artist, if that's the look that you want, you shouldn't feel terrible about selecting such materials, because again, as I said earlier, good science has gone into the formulation of many of these companies. If you think the sponsor of the show, Benjamin Moore, they've been around since 1887. They don't survive as a company by making substandard products. They make very good paint. Here's the Duco brochure. Sorry?
Nice free plug.
Well, I felt a little guilty because I had this Sherwin-Williams catalog, and I just buy this stuff on eBay. And if there was a Benjamin Moore catalog online, I'd buy it. But it was Sherwin-Williams. So I had to, like, balance things out. So here's a Duco brochure. And I think many of you probably have heard the name and know that Pollock used it and other artists have used it. You might think of it exclusively as a car paint. DuPont, again, like any good company, wants to get as large an audience as possible. They're recommending it for furniture, woodwork, and automobiles. Try going to Home Depot and ask for a paint I'm looking for a paint for automobiles, woodwork, and fine furniture. They'll think you're mad. But DuPont thought they could pull it off. And here you see how to paint an automobile. You roll up your shirt sleeves, you bite your lower lip, and you just carefully brush across. I mean, the interesting thing about Duco is that it was a very forgiving paint as a home user. So you could buff it out quite nicely. So if it dried fast and there were sometimes brush streaking, but you could polish that out quite nicely. So there are aspects about its properties that are good. Soy oil paint. Again, in the Depression, there were a couple of things going on. It was a combination of World War II, the United States government restricted the use of linseed oil to army applications. So the paint industry had to respond, and they thought the whole scene would change with soy oil paint. What's interesting is this is an outcropping of the chemergic movement from this time. And that was this sense that this country could become self-reliant or independent from other countries for natural resources. They thought they could grow everything. And so soy took on this level of importance not only as a food for its nutritional value, but also as its possibility as a substitute for oil paint. And the early days of soy paint was just mixed with tung oil, which is a substandard product. But subsequently, they changed it to alkyd formulations, and these paints became very durable. And they're perfectly good quality paints. So it might strike you as odd that the chemergic movement had such an impact on this country, but in some regards, it actually did. So I think this is my last slide, and by 1947, I thought that this would be a nice time to end because color chart picks up in the 1950s, in mid-century, and you get this sense that there's this new crop of materials. And this was a magazine, again, published by DuPont, creating almost like a hysteria of, there's such a demand for their products. But in a way, it was true. And certainly by the 1950s, you have the technology in place and you have the natural resources in place to really make an expert paint. And I cannot emphasize enough, I don't hesitate to say this, that these paints are basically good quality. They have intrinsic properties that if you want to fight against them, it's kind of a losing battle, and you're going to have disdain for these materials. But if they possess the intrinsic properties that you as an artist like, mainly their opacity, their flow, their lack of brush strokes that are retained after drying, the enamel-like effect, essentially, you shouldn't feel guilty about using these. So I think, I'm sure that I have not followed my notes, but we have a discussion afterwards, and I'm sure I'll be able to touch upon things at that point. So thank you for your attention.
I've got this choice. I can either see you, or I can see my notes. I'm afraid I'm going to have to look at the notes. I'm going to talk slightly more directly, I suppose, about the subject of chromophobia and chromophilia, but I hope it'll also bend round to me talking about the issues that arise from the colour chart and from Chris's talk. And incidentally, I feel no guilt whatsoever about not using artists' colours. And actually, I feel much more a sense of liberation by being able to get away from what I felt as someone who was originally a painter, as a kind of the constraints of colour theory that went with artist colours, colour mixing and so forth. But yeah, I hope we can get round to maybe talking about that a bit later. I really hate this. I've only been wearing glasses. No, I shouldn't be talking about that now. Quite recently. It takes a while to get used to them. So you can make faces at me now and I won't notice. The first thing to say is that everything I've written about colour, and that's really all I have written about in the last 10 years or so, has really emerged from my practice in the studio. And in that sense, it's a product of the experience of being in the studio and working with colours in a practical, material way, more than, rather than actually directly an academic interest, although clearly it's been informed by reading academic work and kind of contributing to that that discourse, I guess. That applies mostly, I think, particularly to my book Chromophobia, which, as Anne said, was published in 2000. Back then, in the olden days, I think I might have thought that the terms which we're using for the title of the talk this evening, chromophobia, literally the fear of colour, chromophilia, the love of colour, Incidentally, I thought in about 1997, when I first used the term chromophobia, that I'd made it up. It actually turned out that I hadn't, but that's another story. Although it also turns out that people have ripped it off since, but that's also another story. I think I might have thought back then that you could kind of divide up art between the chromophobic and the chromophilic, between art that's about the love of colour and art that's about the loathing of colour. As if these were opposites and they were mutually exclusive alternatives. And although in some respects it didn't quite work because this sense of this fear of colour and this love of colour seemed actually rather strangely closely related. So I thought, you know, maybe you could go around dividing up the world between the chromophobic and the chromophilic. Not that I ever did, and not that I actually think that's a particularly interesting thing to do. I think my experience working in the studio before and since then and talking with people and just thinking about the subject more and more is that this relationship between the phobic and the philic, between the loathing and the loving, is much more complex, and the two apparent opposites are much more intimately related forces, if you like. And I think that actually what one can think of as the chromophobic and the chromophilic, the fearing and the loving of colour, as being almost two parts of the same operation, and that they often coexist in a work, in a single work. In fact, I would even go as far as say they probably must coexist. And there will always be a, however chromophilic you are in your work or in your dress sense or whatever, there will also be some kind of resistance to that, and vice versa. And I hope I can try to sort of demonstrate that partly by looking at aspects of the show, the colour chart show that Anne curated, and also by looking at elements of my own work. What I would say now is that our relationship with colour in the West, and I have to preface everything I say by saying in the West, because I don't have I'm not in a position to talk beyond that, obviously, enough. I think our attitude towards colour in the West is, in a very specific and strong sense, ambivalent. Ambivalent in a specific sense of meaning the coexistence of contrary, powerfully contrary feelings. To feel strongly in opposite ways simultaneously about something. It's what Freud thought we felt about our parents. You love them and hate them at the same time. He was probably right on that one. That's to say, and I think in terms of colour, I think that it seems to me that we are both strongly attracted to it in some quite profound senses, and at the same time we experience a kind of repulsion from it. And I think you can observe this in various ways. That is to say, I think that at the moment in which we summon up colour, in whatever ways that might be, in art, in an exhibition, or in dress or whatever, the moment in which we summon it up, we also repress it in certain ways, or at least we contain it. We in a way, colour is always offers up the idea of it being totally, as it, you know, for maybe for Eve Klein or something, it would be completely free of line or free of any constraint, the liberation of colour that Eve Klein talked about so beautifully. But even in an Eve Klein work, that colour is in some senses always contained by, well, a rectangle of a canvas or board in his case, or contained by a soggy sponge or something. So there's that moment of summoning up colour, but also that moment, inevitably, of containing it at the same time. And I think it's both a psychological experience we go through. It's also, for artists, it's a practical thing. You can only summon up colour and contain it at the same time, more or less. I think psychologically our ambivalence to colour is manifested often in a form of anxiety or uncertainty. Practically, well, I say it's when we summon up colour, it's a fact that we will find either physical or theoretical containers within which to contain that summoning up. I think the exhibition colour chart demonstrates that ambivalence very, very well, and very vividly. It is a show It's a great show. It's a great show. It's a great show in the way that it summons up color. And, you know, and as I've written before, you know, it's weird in a way for me that in the visual arts, you know, you might expect, if you're an innocent in the world, that color would be one of the first things you see. We actually very rarely see shows about color. You very rarely see much writing about color, even if the works that are being discussed are intrinsically colorful in themselves. The show is a great summoning up of color, a brilliant summoning up of color, but it is also about containing that color. And you know, the title of the show quite specifically, I think, gives you that ambivalence. Color, on the one hand, and chart, on the other. And the chart is that moment of containing, and to some extent, in some respects, repressing color as well. And I think, you know, that's clearly not a criticism of the show. I think it's an inevitable part of that process of summoning up. So I think the show is, as much as it is about color, it is also about, well, it's about rectangles. And you know, it's a show of rectangles as much as it's a show of color. And that the rectangle, for me, in this show, in a way, is the evidence of the anxiety almost about the process of summoning up color, or the constraint that often goes with it. Now, I mean, it's not just you know, Anne's show that exhibits this. Without question, my own work has been also dealing with that relationship between the summoning up and the containing. And as I was thinking about this talk, I realized that I could very easily describe pretty much everything I've made in a studio as color containers. So that would also carry that ambivalence of being both the summoning up of and the sort of holding down of at the same time. And in some extent, my work has been based, some of my work of the last 15 or so years has been about trying to find ways or see whether it's going to be possible to produce work with color in such a way that you don't contain it. What I want to do is really just go through a few works. And I hope I can narrate them in terms of the color chart a bit, I hope, which sort of show something of what I mean by this process. These are some works from 97. Early works I will spare you the prehistory of these works, when I wasn't using color at all. I became interested in color in the early 1990s, partly because it seemed that there was so little of it being used at the time. This was in a period of which approximately goes down to sort of neoconceptualism. The moment I did start using color in the studio, pretty much by accident, it seemed to me that there was something there that I didn't understand, but seemed to offer a kind of something to work with, which wasn't being worked on very much at that time, or at least as far as I was aware, in East London. I eventually started making these mobile color chart things called monochromobiles, monochromes on wheels. It was a way of supporting the color, quite literally. Also, the idea of the relationships between the colors should be kept very mobile, you know, almost literally, that you could rearrange the colors. However, you know, they are rectangles of color. They're rectangles of color. They are the summing up of color, but also the containing of it in very, very, you know, emphatic rectangles. And that always slightly bothered me. That, you know, if, as I was beginning to write and read about color and thinking about the way in which color is a kind of an excess, I was also aware that I was, you know, I was summing up this excess, but also holding it in. Now, when you run out of anything to say, change the slide. Works every time. And the colors in particular that I was interested in, and this is where the color chart comes in, are the colors that you find in the city, not the colors of nature. And I think the color, I mean, as Chris has you know, began to point out, I mean, the colors that are available by virtue of modern technology are fantastically rich, fantastically varied. And for me, the color chart is an opportunity to abandon the traditional artist colors entirely and to abandon the protocols and conventions that go with them. It's a kind of enabling condition for me, I think, I'm sure, for many artists, that enables you to move into plastics, petrochemical colors, illuminated color, all these things which are outside color as nature and outside the traditional forms of painting. And as I kind of, as it dawned on me in the studio that if my work was about color in the city, then I thought, well, I better look at the more typical forms of color in the city. And that's pretty much very largely, not entirely, illuminated color. So electrical and petrochemical color, plastics, plexiglass, and fluorescent light, in effect. And I would nominate the plexiglass swatch book, the chips of plexiglass. There's another color chart in a three-dimensional form, and I kind of collect them a bit, but not nearly as weirdly as Chris does. And don't get me wrong, I'm extremely jealous of his color chart collection. I intend to steal it. So I started getting old commercial, these are all found objects I use from the city, dollies, commercial light boxes, which would be advertisements for restaurants or whatever, exit signs and such like, and putting in panels of transparent or translucent or opaque plexiglass. But even with these, even when you've got color that's glowing, it's still being contained. It's still in the rectangle. And there's still that sense of you're limiting exactly the thing you're trying to summon up. This is a rather large version of that. They're basically on steel Dexian shelving units, and they're just as many light boxes as I could muster together, and not exactly randomly associating the colours, but trying to organise the colours in a sense that was not given by a pattern or by a system or by a rule, but by a sense of them having a sort of vivid relationship with one another. It's a sort of suck it and see method. And this is a smaller one in a niche weirdly, in the Treasury building in central London. But one thing that's evident in this image is that, as you can see on the sides by the stairwell, you do get a spillage of colour, and you get the reflections coming through. And I think it's in this in particular that I began to get interested in the idea that you can throw colour, and you can throw it out beyond its container. I'm clearly not the first person to figure that one out. But it's, for me, and this is just an image of I take a series of photographs of works when they're installed in buildings, particularly with their shiny surfaces. Now, the reflection is the most ephemeral. I mean, Baudelaire had the great definition of modernity as being the ephemeral, the fugitive, and the contingent. It's a phrase I absolutely love. But in a way that a reflection of colour is ephemeral, fugitive, and contingent, it's also entirely dependent on the viewer's position. And on the contingencies of that environment, and it's not, in a way, it's not even there. It's something you observe, but in a way, it doesn't exist, at least outside the viewer's field of vision. The person standing next to you will not see the same thing as you. And maybe it's in something like reflections that you start getting the possibility of a sort of disembodied and uncontained color. These are color containers. They're plastic bottles got in a supermarket with a fluorescent light stuffed through them, kebabs of coloured bottles. And they kind of glow. And you do get a spill of colour, even though you also get that restriction of them. These are kind of wasp's nest of the same in the South Bank in London at the Festival Hall. Again, there's still that sense of the containment, I think. The work I went on to, which I guess I'm still working through, is when I started concealing the light source of the work, you can then use colour to reflect colour off another surface. And then when you do that, you get, in a way, you can kind of begin to work with the effects of reflection and so forth. And these are basically like the previous dollies, but reversed out. They're the sort of negatives of them. The previous dollies were rectangles of colour surrounded by a dirty steel or wooden frame. These are dirty rectangles of timber or steel surrounded by a sort of frame of a spill of colour. And the colours will spill into each other from between the different objects. The inspiration, if that's not too big a word for these, were those pimped-up cars you get in pimp my dolly kind of thing. There's a restriction that you don't get to see the light source, but you get to see the effects of the colour. And for me at least, this was a possible way of beginning, not exactly to completely free colour. I want where the colour comes from and its crude material basis to be evident in the work. But at the same time, you want it to escape the work. I wanted to escape you. I don't know what you want. That's what I want. And so I began working with this sort of silhouetting device for a while, and to some extent still do. This was a commission for a tube station in London where they have a program called Platform for Art. Get it? And I got hold of loads of spare detritus from London Underground and used them as the basis for hanging these silhouetted shapes and then sticking some fluorescent lights behind with polycarbonate colored tubes on them and throwing the light against these niches. I do niche art a bit. But of course, you know, if the color escapes the container, which is the steel central silhouetted element, it's then also contained by the niche. So you know, again, it's a process which is kind of continuous, I guess. And okay, a photograph. Someone was, I'm slightly self-conscious because someone was at a talk I did last night, and she's going to know what jokes are coming next. But I can't help that. This is a guy paying insufficient attention to my work. This is a work which is probably one of the most recent works, which is, again, it's made up of light boxes, a fairly familiar material. But rather than projecting them outwards, throwing them against a wall, just about a foot away from the wall surface. And I actually hadn't made the work with this in mind. I'd made the work to be seen the other way around and to be seen from two sides. And I never liked the front of it. So in a slight, it's one of those sort of exasperated moments in the studio, which anyone who has a studio will know, when you've spent 4 months working on something and you finish it and you don't like it, you don't want to throw it away. You want somehow to salvage something from it. And you often have to make a fairly desperate move to do that salvaging. And my move was to flip it around. And the minute I did that, I realized that I thought there was something, it became more interesting. I mean, I put all the work into the arrangement of the colors on the front. And the minute I got rid of that work, made that invisible, the work became, as far as I was concerned at least, more interesting to look at. And more ambivalent, more odd. I think it's quite a strange thing to have. It looks like it's looking away from you. And art doesn't usually do that, I guess. It had begun life as one of these, which was a barrier piece between two rooms, where from one side you've got the glorious glowing colour, all from plexiglass panels, and then from the other gallery you've got the sort of back of the stereo effect. And I guess the thing about the work, two slides before, is that it combines, in a way you get both at the same time, rather than having to separate out those two moments. How am I doing for time? Okay. So there's at least for me, there's a sort of possibility of the relative, or there's a reduction of the condition of containment of colour in some work. This is another colour container. Not one I want to go on about that much. It's what you call a dumpster with lots of colours in it. Obviously enough. The one thing I guess I began to get a little bit concerned about that was I made my first electric colour tower in 2000. And I was in a show, there was a Dan Flavin show, a fantastic Dan Flavin show in London in 2005. And Bloomberg, who sponsored the show, did a parallel show in their own space of artists working with colour and light. And I realized around then, during the course of this show, that my work, I was being referred to as a light artist. And I really have a big problem with that. I don't know why particularly, except that the subject of my work isn't light. The subject of the work is color as you experience it in the city, and one of the ways in which you experience color in the city is through illumination. But it's not the only way. That's why I didn't want to get typecast, and the art world has a terrible tendency to typecast you. So I vowed when I did a talk at this light art show that my next exhibition would be titled Unplugged. It would be my acoustic album. But I had no idea, absolutely no idea at the time how I was going to realise that. But, in the nature of my work is to go and look in the city at where you find colour and what types of colour you find and what materials that colour is in. And one of the most extraordinary repositories of colour in the city, and colour is not universally distributed through the city, as anyone paying attention, obviously that becomes evident. It's not in London in the more sophisticated regions of Mayfair and South Kensington. They tend to be rather grey and sort of serious looking. It's often in the poorer parts of the town. And in London, that's often in East London, where I live, a lot of artists live. And there's one fantastic space for which is a repository of colour, which is what we call pound shops, and what you call 99-cent stores. And they are unbelievable places, and I've become a complete addict of these places. And you go in, and there's just hundreds of implements, cheap implements, pegs, combs, toys, bouncy balls, etc., which are made of vividly coloured, often fluorescent, Dago plastics. I mean, enough to give a conservation scientist a heart attack, I suspect, but because they ain't that durable, and I've discovered that once they'd stayed in sunlight for a while. And I began just to collect more colour containers, just to collect these objects, implements, and then to, with my slightly OCD tendency, to then cluster them in according to colour. And they became the basis of the next body of work I made. The most extraordinary thing about these pound shop materials, 99-cent store materials, all these plastic objects are made wherever you get them. If you get them in London, you get them in New York, in Berlin, wherever you are. They're all made in the same place. They're all made in the People's Republic of China. And I know this. I'm not a sociologist, I'm an economist, but some of my students went to the Sharjah Biennale in the United Arab Emirates a while ago, and they found the UAE equivalent of a pound shop, or whatever the hell that is, and they bought some stuff back for me. Well, same, yeah, pound shop, yeah, but yeah, you couldn't afford to go in a pound shop, could you? You poor people. and they brought back some. They wanted to get a good pass mark, these students. They brought back some pegs and combs and stuff from the Sharjah pound shops. And they weren't just sort of similar to, they were absolutely identical to the ones I got in London. So it really is a global economy, a very, very interesting global economy. And it's an economy that enables people who can't afford to consume to consume. And the colour, the bright, vivid colour, is in a way a marker of their, how far down on the consumer food chain these people are. But it's also a sort of momentary relief from that knowledge, I guess. They're great places, and it's kind of interesting if you go in and you buy 60 quid's worth of stuff, which I often do, and you become a friend of the family for life. And they wave you out of the shop and say, come back tomorrow. And so I began to make just a series of works, sort of pillars of these works, getting on my favoured Dexian steel, punched steel, tools. And there were some colour-coded, some multicolour. I always said I don't do nature, but they do have a slightly forest-like appearance. This is just a sort of detail. Feather dusters, good colour source. And very lastly, it's a project I'm working on at the moment for an exhibition by the seaside in the south of England. These are made from very, very cheap Brazilian sunglasses. And if you put 30 of them together in a certain way, they actually make a sphere, which I call an eyeball for very obvious reasons. And I'm kind of interested in working with sunglasses, partly because they are fantastically, weirdly, and they're rubbish as sunglasses, positively dangerous, I suspect. But they are genuinely, I think, beautiful things. And if you can slightly modify them or manipulate them in such a way that you actually look at them as for what they are, as objects, rather than from how you might use them, I think there's a real value in them. They have a lightness too. And then, the kind of art I work with is kind of, I always feel slightly old-fashioned, and it's about looking at things. And it is about opticality. It is about how we look, and where we look, and in what ways we can look at stuff, and the fascination of looking, of eyesight, of how we experience the world through that particular sense organ, and what I also discovered is, if having said I'd gone unplugged, is that if you then shine a light on one of these, you get a cheap and instant light show, and if you put them on a motor, which these are on motors and they rotate, you then get a kind of a kaleidoscope effect. I'm going to stop.
I'm actually going to take the chance of get the scarf out of the mic's way. Can you hear me fine in the back? Thanks. Of continuing from where we left off, if any of you in the audience were at the prior conversation with John Baldessari and Daniel Buren, one of the things that came out in that conversation that didn't really get fully, well, it never will be exhausted, but that really propelled right into these two talks, I thought, was this very mysterious issue of color and comedy. And both of you were incredibly entertaining speakers. We could have listened to both of you for the whole hour, and both of you were, like, win the punctuality awards for speakers who do not monopolize the whole time. But there's just such pleasure, and not only pleasure, because I think that part's obvious, but actual humor in so much of what color's about. And one thing that I haven't mentioned in all the sorts of talks I've given about the exhibition or tours of it is the kind of confession, I suppose, that one of our criteria for selecting works to be in the show was if they made us laugh. And there is so much in the exhibition that really, when we saw it or came across it, it was just this pure laughter reaction, whether it's of delight or whether it's of surprise or whether, you know, it just tickles your funny bone. But both of you are very good this way, and both of you had a lot of things to look at in your talks, even if they were not intended to be humorous. Certainly were that. I wondered if it's a topic either of you have ever thought about.
Well, no. I saw my work as tragic. And I'm frankly appalled that you... Is it working?
I think you aren't loud.
Hello? Am I working? No. Have I switched myself off? No, it's on. Can you hear me anyway? Yeah, right, whatever. That's an interesting... I've never thought of that before. I mean, I'm very interested in the idea of delight in art, and I think art's about delight, often, not always.
Now you're worse.
Am I now?
Yeah, I put it back on your lapel. And just...
Nasty little thing. Okay. I'd be very interested in pursuing that idea. I mean, you know, clowns paint their faces, I guess. I mean, there is a relationship between color and comedy. I think it's also, it is probably a sort of psychological fact of vivid colors that it's difficult to do tragedy with them. I suspect tragedy is performed in black and white and comedy is performed in color, yeah. But then, you know, they are twinned sides of,
yes,
of drama.
Yes.
So.
Well, in the brochures that I have, you often find humor in the risks they illustrate people taking. And it's a way of coaxing people to use these by graphically illustrating the risks these novice painters will take. And so there is humor. But I think that in a way it's meant to kind of disarm and encourage people to, in this case, pick up the brush,
yeah,
and give it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if you also deal with color metaphorically, which we do all the time, we talk about sweet and sour colors and hot and cold colors. It's very hard to think of color being heavy.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you can. Brown. A lot of English artists use brown. I mean, it's very hard to think of vivid colors as having weight. So there's a tendency to, I think, associate color with lightness, and then lightness has a, you know, metaphorical connection with some forms of comedy. But you know, I want to sort of, I know you're not saying this, but I don't think it's in its lightness, I think, is its complexity too.
Yes. Yeah. One of the things about you're not wanting to be an artist who works with light,
yeah,
reminded me of something that made Flavin very angry and would still make him be turning over in his grave. So many artists or so many people refer to him as an artist who works with neon.
Ah, well.
Because people don't really grasp the difference between fluorescent and neon light. But in fact, the whole point of Flavin, not the whole point, a key point of Flavin's choice to use fluorescence was that internationally fluorescent bulbs came and come only in a palette of 10 colors, three of which are three kinds of white. And that restriction with which he worked for three decades was actually extremely important to him in terms of perhaps what you're calling the containment part of the equation. Neon, on the other hand, is something which is custom-made in any shape or form for any design or color shade that anybody wants to order. The chemicals can be made in that manner. And so the limitation of color that fluorescence provided to him, he saw as a point of pride. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, about your work, but also in terms, Chris, of how you see that in terms of this kind of evolution in the market of lots of selection. You know, what? When does containment be a point of pride as opposed to something you're actually ashamed of? Or
going to go for that one? I'm sure we'll answer it in different ways.
But I'll start. And I'm not sure about the early evolution in fluorescence, but it was necessary to establish standards. And I think that there have been slight shifts in fluorescent technologies, but basically you're right. I mean, they have very specific standards that control the color temperature. I mean, this is something that you even see a problem today with compact fluorescence, as you feel, you know, as you strive to be green, you try these compact fluorescents out, and some work well and others just don't work for the right environment. But if you look at some of those colors that you consider garish, they were probably something that a constraint that Flavin might have leveraged. I mean, it's not so much with regards to the color charts or the things that I've collected in the past, but obviously constraints can be liberating. And my sense of the things that I've collected is, in a way, the early brochures demonstrate this kind of paroxysm of options. Like, we'll do, you know, trying to accommodate. And it's like, we can do anything. Perhaps their supplies are uneven, so they don't know what they're going to be making next. But certainly, by the mid-century, by the mid-20th century, there are standards in place. And you suddenly see, like with the Duco chart, very fixed options in front of you. And so I you know, it's probably just, you know, perhaps it's just, I hate to say this, but just standard business practice to kind of limit your palate, because if you try to offer every option up to anybody that wants anything, profit margins go down. But let's not talk about that.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
I think artists always work with constraints and need constraints to work with, and, you know, because you've got to go to the studio and just get on with something. And you know, there's the amount of things you could look at. It's like, you know, if you go into a bookshop without a sense of a book you want to read, I always end up coming out with nothing.
Or the video store.
Yeah, because you just, and I think Flavin's generation in particular reveled in the idea of a certain kind of constraint, and of setting it, you know, often arbitrary, but really important limits on, you know, what they would allow, what they would work within. And I think, I don't know exactly the rationale for that. I don't want to say, it was a reaction against abstract expressionism, because that's too easy, because they also had their constraints they were working with. But, you know, the constraint of the, you know, the rectangle, the square, the linear, the vertical and the horizontal line, which is a, you know, characteristic of pretty much that entire generation's those we associate with minimalism most directly, you know, those kinds of constraints. Like, what can you make by limiting yourself? And I think when you really push it, I mean, some of the best artists of the 20th century have set themselves such tough constraints, but that's a condition of the brilliance of their work. And the obvious one for me is Mondrian, and I think Flavin is one of the others. But other artists work in different ways, you know. And
it's not the only way.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the things also that commonly came to mind as you two gave your separate talks was the degree to which class and color come up as connected issues. And really one of the joys for me in preparing the exhibition was the discovering, to the extent that I did, of how much talking about color isn't talking about art, but is talking about culture or talking about society and everything that goes into that bucket. And I wonder if, you know, this is something that you just wanted to add to a little bit.
I mean, I
it's a vast subject,
it is.
Obviously.
But it was certainly something that I noticed and reflected on in Chromophobia. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, class and color are very important relations. And in the West, in particular, color is associated with, well, either with, you know, a kind of working class culture, well, not so much that specifically, as a lack of sophistication that you might associate with, you know, a badly educated, you know, class or subclass. So I think there's very strongly, there are those. There's also, you know, but again, you have to be careful about these generalizations. You know, there is an association of color and kitsch.
Yeah.
By which is meant often, you know, working class culture of some sort, or mass culture at least. At the same time, certain designers, you know, because of that tendency in, you know, in sort of upmarket culture to restrain the palette, that's given certain designers the opportunity, in a way, to bring in very bright colors to a very refined market. So, you know, so it is the case, and yet you can also find always found counter examples.
Yeah.
I mean, Izzy Miyake is one example, I think. Alexander McQueen is probably another, where you get that strategic mobilization of what appears to be unsophisticated color, or suddenly bright color.
Made suddenly very expensive.
Oh, yeah. and the other thing is that association with color with other cultures.
Yes.
That's, again, another form of apparent lack of sophistication. You know, they like their bright colors. And, you know, as a kind of cliche about, you know, the Orient or Africa,
yes,
and whatever.
Yes.
But I think that's, you know, it's the same kind of slightly phobic mobilization of color.
Yes. Yes.
It's not exactly the typical painting you would expect in color chart, but if you think of Siqueiros and his use of Duco, cellulose nitrate, his sense was, he wasn't the first to use these commercial paints, but I think he was one of the first artists to really force a new technique. And he was really convinced that in making art for the people that you had to use common house paints. And he insisted upon this with his students, that they not only abandon the bourgeois artist materials, but also the tools of the artist. And he's really, I mean, talk about constraints. I mean, that was, you know, how he practiced, how he discovered these new techniques. So,
and it seems to me not at all accidental that the first work, the earliest work in the show is by Duchamp, and the other artist who was using commercial colors was Picabia.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's associated with Dada,
yes,
which was an assault on, you know, the on high culture of its time,
yeah,
and it's certainly a kind of academic art of the time. And, you know, the parallel to that would be Soviet constructivism, which also saw itself as a kind of, you know,
yeah,
as a revolution in color or a revolution in art to parallel the social revolution and political and economic,
yeah,
revolution that they,
yeah,
imagined that they were going to go,
yeah,
through.
I know it's been said, I'm not sure if it's been said tonight, but this is what's beautiful about the show, is the approach to paint as the concept of a ready-made. And that's what's so beautiful about Duchamp using these paints, is that it's natural for him to reach for these paints. It's totally natural. It's really...
Although when Duchamp wrote about the ready-made, he said, you know, actually, paint in a tube is a ready-made too, which you then mix, you know, color in the can. Then he also said, you know, your parents are ready-made. So pretty much everything in Duchamp's universe became a ready-made at some point. But then, you know... It's...
Well, as I was putting my slides together, I was really... I know my mind must be playing tricks on me, but I could swear that I saw a brochure that said ready-made paints. But every time that I looked, it was ready-mixed or mixed-ready or...
Yeah, yeah. No, but I'm sure you are right. It was in the water,
somewhere,
in the air.
Yeah.
Did you have questions for each other? We were very excited as when we were planning this series last year. We thought of getting Chris and David together as two chromophiles who had not met. But apart from David's opportunity now to steal Chris's collection, is there any other...
No, my only question was, do you have any spares? Or, when did you start collecting them?
Well, probably around the year 2000. And I've tapered off, but I've kind of gained this reputation now for, like, birthday and Christmas presents. I get color charts. But my colleagues at other institutions collect these. And I have several cans of Ripolin paint. The first paint can that I got, I paid, like, $24 for.
How old is this can?
This one was from the mid-1930s. Still liquid, never opened. Then there was a second can that I bought, which is from somewhere between 1918 and 1920. And I ended up paying like $140. I should say the department ended up paying my wife's in the audience. The department ended up paying $115. So really expensive. And then there was another can on eBay, another can of Ripolin. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to get this one. I put like a bid of $250 on it, and I didn't get it. And I sent with eBay, you can communicate with the winning bidder, and explained, you know, my interest, explained who I am, because you can't, by my eBay name, you can't figure out who I am.
I would love this even more than you would.
Well, you know, I explained, maybe you're interested. No reply. So it's sad.
I'm mystified.
Yeah, things have kind of gotten out of control.
Did you have questions in David's
question? For David, it's not so much a question. It's just an affirmation of the transition between our talks, actually, how he opened his remarks by saying how he feels liberated by these paints. And I guess maybe I think I might know the answer, but it would be really nice to have David kind of go into that, because time and time again, I read these accounts of artists using these materials, and I also have my own feeling about how liberating, because let me just say, and maybe this is going to be part of your answer, part of the reason why I don't want to say passionate, but so positive about these materials is that if you think of, say, the 16th, 17th century, the relationship that you would have to have with your patron to be able to paint on such a large scale is limiting, because you... For a Rubens to paint a commission, you've got to stroke somebody's ego. And as an artist now, granted these paints aren't dirt cheap, but they're not expensive. And so I see that this access means you don't have to kiss up to a patron. You don't have to kiss up to a pope. You don't have to kiss up to a government official to be able to paint or to be able to work on such a large scale. And is scale...
I wish. Well, so go on. Is scale... Well, you know, I mean, when I did a chandelier of plastic bottles, there were 500 of them. And that ends up using 10 kilometers of cable. And that actually ends up being quite expensive. And you can't just do that on a whim in your studio. The studio is probably not big enough. You'd need people to work with it because it's just so time-consuming. And then, you need somewhere to hang it. So actually, it's you're right that to a degree, I don't think it's actually made that much difference actually, because I mean studios are expensive and everything that goes. If the paints are a bit cheaper, great, but the studio's going to be more expensive and such like. Now. So, I mean, there is something about pound shops, on that, which is something. But even so, but to go back to your question about that feeling of liberation about using these colours. It was partly that, you know, I was taught bad colour theory at art school, and the fact that if you there's an infinitesimal difference between, you know, different mixes of colours, and if you can just go and buy it, then you save yourself a lot of time and anxiety. And then you think, I can just go and repeat the order. But actually, of course, you repeat the order and the colour comes out slightly different each time. You know, batches of colour are not that consistent bought through the colour chart mechanism. But I think the other thing about, the really important thing about beginning to use those kinds of materials and colours is that I felt like it was getting closer to the world. And I felt it was very hard to make a work which related to the world that I was experiencing and interested in by painting on canvas with oils or even acrylics. And, you know, and I think that's just, I'm not saying that other people can't do it. I wasn't able to make work with that technology and those materials and somehow make it feel like it had a vivid relationship with the world out there that I was trying to interact with through my work. And it was through the materials of plastics of various kinds and light and you know, those support materials I've been using that I felt that the work was began to make that kind of connection. I suppose that was in a way the most important thing for me.
That's great.
Thanks. Yeah. Let me open it up. Yes. With a hat.
Thank you. 1, 2, yay. Hi. I am wondering, it's known that the peak sensitivity of the human retina is about 530 nanometers, and that's like a green color. So if you had a 1-watt bulb of green, it would appear much brighter than a 1-watt bulb of red or blue.
Correct.
And so the question is, do you know of any ways that paint makers have incorporated the sensitivity spectrum of the human retina, or artists have used that sort of dependence on wavelength of the sensitivity to either get an artistic effect or a utility effect?
I take it that everyone in the audience is aware that 530 nanometers is that. It is a particular form. I mean, I've tended to use a green. I've always looked out for the sharpest colours, the fairly unsubtle colours that are available, not the kind of complex maroons or navies, but this very sharp yellow green, and that is about that 500 nanometer mark, I think, and it's the colour that the eye registers in a way most quickly, and is. And often people paint bad sports cars that colour because it makes them feel like they're going fast, even if they're rubbish cars, I guess. So in a very informal way, I have been aware and attracted to the effects of those kinds of colours on the eye.
Here comes the mic for you.
I started thinking about color of flags and nationalistic colors, and those as a form of color chart also, and how they're both, you know, sponges and they leak and they're spray cans and, you know, they sort of have all of these, it's a political dimension of color, and I just thought you might comment on that some way.
You said flags.
Yeah, flags. Yeah. Yeah.
Then you said sponges and spray
cans. Well, I was just thinking how flags as a political dimension of color, as flags are forms of a political dimension of color, are sort of sometimes like sponges or spray cans or, you know, depending on how they're used or absorbed and culturally.
Flags generally, I mean, in terms of national flags and such like and flags to represent organizations, they tend to have a very, very limited color range, I think. And the most common which is red, white, and blue, I think. For reasons that are completely elude me. I mean, I've not studied in a way that kind of the political sociology of flags particularly at all. You don't get 530 nanometer flags. I wish you did. that would be my flag. But you do get them in spray paints and such like. And if you talk about tagging rather than flagging, then I think there's a... I'll shift around to that. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Chris does.
Sorry.
Another.
idea of what a color looks like is so related to whether the light is on or it's off, how the sun is coming in, what time of day, what color it's next to. Could you address that?
Albers, I think, said color deceives continuously. And it was it's a brilliant phrase. And I originally thought he meant it in a sort of slightly negative way, where, don't trust these colors. His point was that it's so complex, the relationship, when you start putting colors together, and color under one kind of light or another kind of light, the effects, the complexity of the effects is so enormous that it's pretty much impossible to pin it down. And we try to by codifying colors and containing it in various theoretical models and such like. And I think what Albers was really brilliantly aware of, and I have to say I'm not the biggest fan of his paintings necessarily, but he was brilliantly aware of that extraordinary complexity of color, and that how it's in the end it's limitless, the various effects that can be generated, consciously or otherwise. And the slightest change in illumination will affect the experience of the color. A change in size will affect the experience of the color, the amount of saturation, opacity and transparency. We tend to think of everything as in terms of hue, red, green, yellow, and so forth. But the difference between a transparent color and an opaque color is as great as the difference between or a shiny color and a matte color is as great as the difference between different types of hue. And a lot of artists have said, Ad Reinhardt said, we should think of shiny black and matte black as different colors, because the effects on us are profoundly different. We tend to sort of slightly repress those types of difference in favor of differences of hue. This is kind of slightly going off message here, but my favorite, one of the most interesting ways of looking at color is the relationship between color and language. The average human eye is apparently able to detect between 10 and 20 million graduations of color. So it's relatively sensitive instrument, the eye. The average human language has 10 or about 10 or 11 basic color terms in common usage. Now, clearly there's a sort of asymmetry there at least. So we grapple in order to express these observable differences. And one of the great things about color is the way it exposes the limits of language. And we live in a very language-centric culture, I think. And I think it's one of the great values of color to remind ourselves that language ain't that good sometimes. It has its limits.
In the course of preparing the show, we talked quite a bit with Onkawara, one of the artists who features in it and whose date paintings are famously, for the last 40 years, each composed of a mix of colors as unique as the day on which it was made. And we, in speaking with him, really hit quite often on this topic that it is somewhat of a cultural situation, this language-color-perception gap. And I appreciated your mentioning how you were going to limit all your remarks, in the West.
Yeah.
Because it is absolutely true that this is something which, if you go into cultures other than Western Europe and the United States or America, perhaps, the situation is very different. And Onkawara was talking about how if you are in Japan and grew up in Japan, the numbers of colors for which you do have names are in scores, whereas Americans really have them in few handfuls. And, for him, not to overstate it in such a stereotypical, but for him distinguishing between three black paintings he made that we would call black is extremely obvious that they're, this kind of black, that kind of black, and that kind of black, in a way that an American eye, a Native American eye, just wouldn't pick up.
I mean, don't get me started on this because it could take some time. When I said basic color terms, and they say every language has more complex color terms, but not the ones which are, as it were, assumed to be available to all the speakers of that language. Now, there's some research done in the early 1960s by two anthropologists called Berlin and Kay, and they sought to to find out whether all languages have the same basic color terms or whether they are culturally and linguistically dependent. And they studied 25 different languages, English, French, German, and then some very wide ones. And they came up with a thesis that every language they studied, and by extension, every language, every human language, they all had between 2 and 11 basic color terms. And if they were 2, they'd always be black and white. If they were 3, they'd be black, white, and red. And the more developed languages, in heavy inverted commas, would have 11 as such. English is 1, red, yellow, blue, green, purple, orange, since you asked, gray, black, white,
brown,
pink, and brown. Thank you. And now that research has been subject to a huge amount of revision subsequently. And it is a far more complex picture than that, and that I can go into. Two things to be said about it. One is that there's this one language called Hanunu, which is a Malaysia-Polynesian language, as I'm sure you all know. And Hanunu has 4 basic color terms. Dark and light, which we might approximate to black and white, being 2 of them. And the other 2 are fresh and dry. And it takes a kind of effort of the Western imagination to think what on earth that might mean. And I think what approximately it means is the difference that their dominant distinguishing terms are between shiny and matte, rather than between red and green, if you like.
Yeah.
And Hanunu has then become quite a famous language because of this deep, you know, strangeness. And Umberto Eco wrote about it, and others. The second thing to be said about the Berlin K anthropological tests. And they were, I mean, the way they were carried out was incredibly clever, but I won't go into that. And I thought, well, what a great work to do, to travel the world and to go to all these different language groups and say, good morning, what colour is this? And then build it. They never left San Francisco. They did all their work in the Bay Area of San Francisco. This whole body of work was this local language.
Fabulous.
So that was
all
I had to say about it.
No, and it was, speaking about that, it was interesting in doing this research that we found that so much of the anti-color theory in sociological terms work happened exactly at the period that the anti-color theory on the part of artists work happened in the 60s, early 70s, is exactly when scholars and anthropologists and so on turned against this kind of classifying that is exactly what artists were turning against. In a whole different way.
Hi.
I'm interested in
metallic colors, and obviously gold isn't a yellow, and silver isn't a gray, and a bronze isn't a kind of brown or an orange. And those are obviously colors which are now in mass production. You can buy them in paint colors, and we think of them as colors, but they've obviously got a history and they've been raised above color in a lot of ways historically in the West, and I think in most civilizations being sort of elements. I was wondering if you had anything to say about metals and their reflectivity or whatever.
Just about, say, for example, bronze powder paints?
For example.
How you see them as colors, or whether they are above color or distinct from color.
I think, I'll just jump in a little bit. I think some writers on color, I can't remember who it was now, they talk about spectrum colors and non-spectrum colors. I mean, black and white are non-spectrum colours. To some extent, brown is. But also, there are these various metallic colours. And I think it was the... And they are really interesting and strange. They have very interesting and strange characteristics, which are partly about being metallic. And is gold yellow that glitters? Or is it something... Is it different from that? Now, I'm not sure. Is brown dark yellow? We just don't call it dark yellow. I mean, these remain strange to me. I think the artist who exploited particularly things like these non-spectrum colours, particularly metallics, was Judd. He used some extraordinarily bizarre colours in his work. Coppers, I mean, literally copper, brass, and so, but often in conjunction with purple plexiglass or something. And they're bizarre combinations, and they're brilliant combinations, I think. Also, by the 1960s, you could get plexiglass in a very wide range of colours, including various sort of metallics and such like. Now, I mean, Judd was pretty much the first artist to use plexiglass, or we call it perspex in the UK. But you know, that is, it's a very important material because it's a color, it's a material which is intrinsically colorful, as well as being brightly colored. Whereas most metals and so forth, well, not polished metals maybe, but timber and metals are, the intrinsic colors are relatively sober, and the way of getting bright color onto them is to put a surface on them of color. Now, then here with plexi, with plastics, you have an intrinsically brilliantly colored material, which is, you know, in a way as strange as metallics in their way, and as you know, as specific to a kind of, you know, relatively developed industrial culture. Oh yeah, well, and that, I'll let Chris talk about that bit.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, and powdered gold, shell gold, was something that dates back to the medieval times, and if not earlier. But there was certainly in the era David is referring to, just the use of automobile paints as something that really kind of is where things really began to be used in large quantities. Whereas prior to this, I think these bronze powdered paints and so forth were used for just detailing little adornments. But clearly the line was crossed, and the use of these metallic containing paints is something that spread out.
I mean, I'm no Renaissance man of any description, but it strikes me that you can't use gold in a perspective painting because it always sits on the surface. You have to represent the color gold by you know, yellows and highlights and so forth. But in medieval painting, you have gold, you know, to represent a halo or whatever. But that gold always gold will always sit on the surface. It's a surface color. And come the Renaissance and the invention of deep space and so forth, you basically had to get rid of those that technology. It didn't fit within that picture space.
Maybe one more from the back. Sarah? Yeah.
One comment about flags is that I think green is the most commonly used color for flags. And about the show, I had a strange thing where I read the essays before I saw the show, and I was surprised to see how we were referring to containment in color. And by reading the essays, I got a sense of color being mass-produced as being liberating for artists. And I was wondering if you would consider doing an aftermath of the show in the future, where the liberation of color comes through more than just the appropriation and ready-made qualities of color, and what artists you would consider for that show.
Oh, wow. Well, the way of speaking about the show that I've used in many conversations is that it was a project that I wanted to open windows and not to be an exhibition where you left feeling like you had learned your lesson and gotten all the answers and you could wrap up the box with a ribbon. One of my favorite ways of thinking about this is a passage in a book by Roland Barthes, and he's talking about reading, and he's saying that his favorite time when he's reading is when he's prompted to or has the decision or desire to look up from the page. And that whole idea of being of your best time while you're reading is when you actually leave your reading is something I think about a lot when I am working as a curator, because what I want to happen is to have people sort of start doing what it is I've been doing on their own. So maybe this is a bit of a cop-out answer, but I would love to see more shows on color by other people that would follow this one. And I'll mention, by the way, something that you were saying made me think of this. This actually is the first exhibition devoted expressly to color in the history of MoMA, the, you know, 70-odd year history of it now. And maybe I'll leave with a question for these two, of if there is something about the 21st century, because Chromophobia came out in 2000, there does seem to be, at least in this first decade of the 21st century, perhaps an inclination toward this liberation. And do you think that's just a deceptive pattern, and really things haven't changed in any fundamental way?
I'm kind of early to tell. I mean, certainly think from things have changed quite a lot since in the 15 odd years that I've been looking at the subject. I'm not claiming responsibility for that. I think I've simply observed that there's been a sort of an easing up of the kind of maybe that sort of the hangover from conceptual art, perhaps, or from minor conceptual art rather. And I think that there's a much more, there seems to be a great deal more going on and a much more experimentation going on in areas both about colour but also in many, many other ways too. So, and you're seeing a lot of colour being used in architecture now as well, specifically with the development of interleaf glass technology, if you will, which say you get two panels of glass and you stick a film between them, and that gives you very vividly coloured glass. Now, which a lot of David Adjaye in the UK, quite a few other architects have begin to use that. So,
yeah, no, I agree. And in the my last slide with the kitschy question mark about when will there be enough paint, I think the answer is never. And it's not, although my presentation was focused on paint, I ended with that last slide, simply because I don't think there will ever be enough paint for an artist to kind of express themselves, and they're going to be, when bitten by the moment, grab for something else, and whatever it takes to express themselves, they're just going to reach for in whatever technology is permitting at the time. In extension of what David just said about architecture, there are these new developments of making luminous paint where solar panels can actually power a building to make it glow. And this technology is...
Oh, I want one of them.
Yeah, I'm the bright red glowing house on the left. But no, I mean, these are design concepts that are being considered by architects, that are technologically feasible and appear to be sustainable. So there certainly is that as a next step moving forward.
I guess the other thing I would say is that I really did stumble into color in about 1992. And began to work with it, not with a plan particularly at all, or with an aim to do more than just to get by that week, probably. And and to my amazement and to my delight, I found myself 15 years later, absolutely no sign that this subject is, that I'm running out of the subject. I mean, it's gaining on me, that's been a kind of revelation to me, and it's been a great source of pleasure and occasional pain.
On that note.
Pleasure and pain.
Thank you, everybody.